Good afternoon, colleagues, members of the public. I'm calling to order this February 19, 2014 meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources Committee of the Oregon Senate. And we have three bills on the agenda today. We have public hearings and possible work sessions scheduled, hoping we can be productive and get them all done, but we'll see how the public testimony goes. So with that, we're going to go out of order. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4139 and call up Representative Reardon to please introduce this bill for us. Beth, you want to tell us what this bill is while he's coming up?
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 4139 directs the Oregon State University in consultation with the Department of Agriculture to develop educational materials on best practices to avoid adverse effects from pesticides on population of bees and other pollinating insects, and it establishes a work group that would be reporting back to the legislative committee related to agriculture no later than October 1st, 2014.
Hey, Representative Reardon.
Good afternoon. I am Representative Reardon, District 48, and thank you so much for having me over today. I really appreciate that, and I will go through my notes briefly so that you can be productive as you wish. So, sorry, had to get it out of the way. This is a very straightforward bill. It's common sense that will help us find a balance between the use of pesticides and the need to help protect the creatures that we depend on to pollinate a wide variety of plants, including plants that provide about 35% of our own food. Excuse me. Neonicotinoids were made available in the mid-1990s, offering a long-term plant protection from sap-sucking insects and touted as being safer for birds and wildlife than earlier insecticides. Six neonicotinoids are found in hundreds of plant protection products found on the shelves of agricultural supply stores and garden centers. But over time, we've learned that there may be some adverse effects to the misapplication of these chemicals, and so we're rather concerned about that, especially after the huge bee kill-offs that occurred in four sites in the Portland area last spring. As you may know, the Department of Agriculture does require training and licensing for those who apply restricted-use pesticides or who apply any general-use pesticide to someone else's property. In response to last summer's bee kill-offs, that program is being improved to include information about the neonicotinoids and their effects on pollinators. As a result of the Department's work in collaboration with Oregon State, the licensed applicators will become better prepared to use the chemicals. So that part of the situation is coming under control. Here's the problem that I'm trying to address. Home gardeners and other users, such as the nursery workers, can go to the farm or garden store, purchase the same kind of pesticides, and they have the only information that they get for sure is on the label. And so they have no training, they don't have to pass a test, anything. We just rely on them to read that label. They are expected to read and follow the directions on the label without fail. There's no way to be sure that as home gardeners and other users have read or comprehended, the labels may not even be in their language. There's no requirement to keep application records, and that's an issue because the some of these chemicals will actually stay active for 6 or 7 years. So you could apply them 1 year and they're still active 6 years later. Who keeps records? So anyway, I do believe that most Oregonians, certainly our agricultural community, they do care deeply about their state and the environment. And I believe that Oregonians are willing to take the steps necessary to ensure that we can protect our pollinators that are critical to food production for both humans and wildlife. But we must find better ways to ensure that people are informed and understand before they begin using the chemicals. So I started with the idea that four of the neonicotinoids should be put on this restricted use list. That would effectively take them off the shelves. There were some different points of view on that issue. And I pulled together some stakeholders that represented environmental groups. Department of Ag was immensely helpful. We had contact with the Oregon State bee experts. League of Oregon Cities, Beyond Toxic, Oregonians for Food and Shelter, the Nursery Association, all chimed in and helped out. We had a few meetings, several phone calls, and as a result of that, a lot of listening that took place, a lot of improved understanding, came up with the bill that is before you today. So I feel great about that process. I think it's one that will allow us to learn a lot more about the issue. Looking at a lot of information, a lot of research will be done by Oregon State University, and we will come back in 2015 with possible legislation, possible other things that we can do to help out.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Yes, Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you, Representative Reardon. We had another situation with pesticides down at Triangle Lake. And it was a problem that the people were being ingesting the pesticides. What I'm getting to is ODA used to have a pesticide registry, and we defunded it many years ago. Do you think that maybe we should look at bringing back some kind of registry or making ODA be more responsible for this? Or, you know, because apparently it didn't work.
Thank you for the question, Chair, Vice Chair. I don't actually want to make an opinion on that, and because I've made a real strong point of getting more information and listening, and I'm not an expert on the registry, and I know that every time there's a question like that, there's about three possible right answers. So I appreciate making me aware of that question.
Thank you.
Well, that's certainly something we can ask be considered as part of the study process.
Absolutely.
So thank you for bringing that up. Any other questions, colleagues? Yes.
Well, more of a statement. You know, with I appreciate the middle ground that you've come to, Representative. I think that's a wise move. It's an emotional issue. Growing up on a farm and in our rural agricultural area, the fact that we're going to study it, I think better public policy will come out as a result of that, and have great faith in the science at OSU and working with the Department of Agriculture that if it ends up there are laws that need to be changed, we'll have some basis for that other than just an emotional response to maybe a one or two incidences that happen to happen. Probably if it wasn't within the Portland metro area, but maybe in the Milton Freewater metro area, it would have been a little bit different response. But I think it's, I applaud your efforts to bring it to a study and go from there.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your support and your help with the process. So let's just get it passed.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Thanks for being here. So, colleagues, I am going to leave open the hearing on House Bill 4139, but I'm going to open a public hearing on HJM 201A because we have a representative here to speak to it. We have people signed up to speak to 4139. We'll go back to that after we hear from Representative Smith Warner, who needs to get to back to the Rules Committee to inhabit the seat that I once held. So with that, I open a public hearing on House Joint Memorial 201. Representative, it is obviously a real pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. Thank you again, Senator Denbrough, for your ascension to the Senate that enabled me to be seated at the House today. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner. I'm the state representative from House District 45, which, as the chair well knows, covers portions of Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. I testify today in support of House Joint Memorial 201A, which was passed out of the House with an overwhelming majority in support on February 13th of this year. HJM 201-A urges Congress to strengthen safety standards for new and existing tank cars used to transport crude oil by rail. There are three reasons that we should act now by passing this memorial. Number one, because more crude oil is now traveling by rail than ever before, and the cars in which that crude oil travels are outdated, can be unsafe and outdated. Number two, because the combination of these two factors is resulting in an increase in spills of crude oil. And number three, because the results of these spills are devastating to communities and families. Domestic oil companies are increasingly relying on freight rail lines to move their product to market. And historically, railroads are a very safe method of ground freight transportation. However, the vast majority of cars used today to transport crude oil are decades old and do not have to meet the same safety standards as cars used to transport other hazardous materials. In fact, of the roughly 92,000 tank cars that are being used today to move flammable liquids like crude and ethanol, only about 14,000, or only 15%, are built to the latest industry safety standards. Fortunately, the need for safety upgrades and for regulations that reflect the latest technology are both well-documented and widely agreed upon. House Joint Memorial 201-A has broad stakeholder support, including from the railroad industry as well as Oregon-based rail companies. Rail car companies. Colleagues, as guardians of our state's public safety, we cannot stand idly by and wait for a preventable tragedy to strike here in Oregon. House Joint Memorial 201-A sends a message to Congress that now is the time to act for the health and safety of our families and communities. I urge your aye vote. I ask that you pass it.
Yes, yes.
And I'm happy to take any questions. And I also, in addition to my submitted testimony, I believe there's also a map in OLIS. It was there on the House side, and I believe we've gotten it to you guys as well, but we'll make sure to. It may have also gotten to your offices of where the rail lines are all through right now, all through the state, where some of these cars are traveling.
Thank you, Representative. Can you stay for a few minutes of questions?
Yes.
And actually, I want to call up Sean Gillians, if I can. We have public testimony, but he also has been invited to speak on this issue. You want to hear from him first? Yeah. Okay, Sean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Gillians today representing the Greenbrier Companies, the second largest producer of rail cars based here in Oregon. We appreciate working with the representative on this memorial. We are in support of the memorial. The Greenbrier Companies have been working with the U.S. Department of Transportation and its Pipeline Safety Hazardous Materials Administration on rules to enhance safety with rail cars. That process has been ongoing since 2011. We think that actions like the U.S. or the state legislature directing Congress to nudge them along in their rulemaking would be beneficial to get that. The Greenbrier Companies are fully committed to a process of retrofitting the existing rail cars and have developed a solution to retrofit existing cars to the higher safety standards. In addition, they are working on a heavy-duty car that would meet potential future standards and go above and beyond that. They plan to start production on that car within 18 months. So we very much appreciate your support of this memorial. Happy to answer any questions about the Oregon-specific relationship of this, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Vice Chair Olson.
Mr. Gillians, you know in race cars they have self-sealing tanks. Is this an area that you're looking at, or are you looking more like double wall construction?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Olson, the latter. There is a way to double wall existing tank cars. There's also an issue with the valves where there's a way to put further safety mechanisms around the valves in case something like what happened in Quebec happens again. It would protect the valve from rupturing.
Thank you.
Further questions? Okay, thank you both. Thank you,
thank
Representative,
you
for bringing this bill to this memorial to us.
Great.
Okay, so we're going to go back to bees, if that's okay. I don't need to gamble or anything.
I'm just recess.
So I'm going to recess the public hearing on HJM 201 and bring us back to the public hearing on 4139. I'd like to call up Richard Taransky. Is it Torrance?
Yes.
Thanks. Christy Split. And Scott Dahman?
Dahman.
Dahman, sorry. Okay, you want to go in order? Yeah.
Sure.
Welcome, Mr. Taransky.
I represent Glorby Foods.
Oh, could you please state your name for the record?
Okay. My name is Richard Taransky, and my wife and I started Glorby Foods 40 years ago, and we're the largest honey packer in the Pacific Northwest today. And I also come as a beekeeper personally for 43 years, and I have personally experienced bee loss due to pesticide damage. I'm a friend of the beekeepers throughout the industry here in the United States and Canada. I am well read in as far as the business periodicals within the business community of beekeeping, the American Bee Journal, the Canadian Bee Journals, and others. I'm here with real serious concern about the beekeeping industry, because the beekeeping industry is declining. And one of the key reasons, I believe, based on the research that I read every day through the journals, that monthly publications, and also another online research that's publishing the data that's coming forth now, that the neonicotinoid pesticides are doing key damage. And the reason is these neonicotinoid poisons are the gravest type of pesticide that's been discovered by the chemical industry. It's the basis of the neonicotinoid poisons are basically nicotine. And nicotine is the most severe type of thing that can kill, you know, both man, animal, and, of course, insect. The research in Europe has caused that the neonicotinoids are banned. They are currently banned in Europe for use. And there's, you know, I think it's a 2-year or 3-year moratorium until further research can be accomplished. In the United States, there is more research that's necessary. The EPA, of course, originally approved these chemicals based solely on the research from the chemical company. They did not do any research themselves. Apparently, new research is occurring now, which we will not know the results for at least 6 years from what has been published. So, you know, we're going to rely on the chemical industry to tell us what's happening, when, in fact, as beekeepers, we know what's happening. This is, by and large, the American Honey Producers Association, the American Beekeeping Federation, their news and information is provided by the beekeepers themselves and their experience, and there is no doubt that these neonicotinoids are doing specific damage, and including Canada, which I also read their research and know for the fact that this is occurring. So, you know, the reason that these nicotinoids are so much more dangerous than when I was doing beekeeping over in Madras, Oregon, is because those pesticides at that time caused the bees to die outside the colony. Today, the research proves that the damage is being done inside the colony because the food for the bees to winter over is the bee pollen. And so it's the bee pollen in the hive that is getting contaminated with the neonicotinoids, and that's what's killing these hives' ability to withstand the wintering process. So, you know, with the constant increase in the shortage of honey being produced in the United States, and of course we know that we're trying to buy more and more honey domestically and finding it much more difficult and much more costly. So, you know, that's my testimony today, and hope that it's received well.
Thank you very much for that, Ms. Taransky. And let me also say thank you for Glory Be Honey. You've given me much pleasure in my life, so thank you. Christy, do you?
Thank you.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, nice to be before you today. I'm representing the Oregon League of Conservation Voters today, and part of the reason that we got involved in the issue of bees has to do with the bee die-offs that happened last summer. The House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee had a very long hearing during the interim on this particular issue, and it's one you might consider taking a closer look at, too, as we launch this task force, assuming that the bill passes, which I certainly hope it does. We heard at that point from folks throughout the industry, everybody from the pesticide industry to other folks in the beekeeping and honey industry. And I think it was really revealing to see that there is a widespread agreement that we have a problem with our bees. And then what causes that problem is where there's some area of disagreement. And so what I'm really excited about to talk about today is that we actually have broad stakeholder agreement on the task force plan that you have in front of you in the A engrossed House Bill 4139. It would have that diverse set of stakeholders continuing to talk about possible solutions as we face increasingly vulnerable bees here in Oregon and making sure that we protect our $600 million per year agriculture industry that's dependent on bees. So just really quickly, I'm testifying today on behalf of both myself and also Ambe Code from the Xerces Society. They're fantastic. They focus on invertebrate health. If you want to nerd out with some people and talk about invertebrates for a while, it's really fun. I highly encourage you to get to know Ame and her coworkers. She submitted some written testimony on behalf of both of us. And you'll see that we do have some concerns with the task force. We want to make sure that we have a response that's equal to the problem. So we're looking forward to having that robust conversation, and we're really glad to have the stakeholder conversation or stakeholder group that we do behind this. And really want to give thanks to Representative Reardon, who got everybody together around a table before session. I know that task forces are, you know, another task force, but it's the Oregon way. It's how we solve big problems, and we look forward to having a solution that matches what looks like a really big problem. So please, for more detail and more information from somebody who knows policy really well, Ame's testimony is on a list for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Christy.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Dahlman. I'm the Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We're a grassroots coalition made up of farmers, foresters, and other chemical users, and we focus on issues involving pesticides, fertilizer, and biotechnology. I'm here today speaking in regards to House Bill 4139 because it could have a profound effect on many of my members. Obviously, we all know why we're here today. There were some high-profile incidents this summer involving bees and pesticides that really brought this conversation to the forefront. But it was about 2005 when we really started seeing some problems with pollinator populations across the United States. EPA pulled a stakeholder group together at that time, pulling the best experts together to try to find out what was going on with this mysterious colony collapse disorder. What they found is that there are many factors contributing to this, and that it is a very, very complicated issue. That is why when the original bill was introduced this year, we had some serious concerns where it felt like much of the blame was being placed on pesticides, and the original bill could have really disadvantaged our growers, and especially a group of pesticides that actually has a very good environmental profile when compared to the alternatives that would be used. And so I have to give a lot of credit to Representative Reardon for reaching out to a broad group of stakeholders. And I think what he realized really quickly was what all of us realized when we got into the room together, was that there's no simple answer for this, and that there needed to be a broader discussion that looked at all of the issues affecting pollinators in Oregon. Because as my members, as growers, feel really squeezed on this because they need pollinators to pollinate their crops, but they also need to have the right tools available to control the pests that will destroy their crops. And so they have a very, very keen interest in this. We were very happy that the bill got amended in the House to set up a stakeholder process, a task force to look at this issue more in depth so we can look at all the science out there, look at what's being done with best management practices so that we can come up with some solutions making forward to make sure that we don't have incidents moving into the future. So we are supportive of this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dahlman. Any questions for the panel?
I had one.
Yes.
Well, for Mr. Transke, good to see you again. And I, in your testimony, I'm assuming, but I want to make sure it's on the record, that you are supporting the bill as it is before us today with the work with the study group. I want to make sure you talked about various issues, but specifically to the bill, would you be supportive of us moving it forward?
Well, maybe I need to ask you some questions in regards to that, because, you know, I just got here today by, you know, divine encounter, being here with this group, and I'm not sure I understand the bill fully. I decided I needed to, you know, come in here and be a witness, just as I came in and they were giving us free time to go to various meetings.
Fair enough.
So
that's okay.
If I could have a better explanation of the totalness of this bill, I would like to clarify that.
Okay.
That'd be clear. Yeah, let me just say one thing. This bill essentially sets up a stakeholder work group to work with Oregon State University, as I understand it, to really look into the issue of the bee die-off and the causes and potential solutions to it. And, you know, sometimes, and I think Christy alluded to this, sometimes task forces get a bad rap, you know, that it's just sort of postponing action and it's just jawboning. But, you know, I'm going to argue, and I think I'm known as a strong proponent of work groups, that there's a lot of legislation that will pass this session, that passes every session, that only passes because it's been prepared by a stakeholder work group, which has been, you know, more or less compelled to come together by legislation that we've passed. So, you know, I think the hope here, Representative Reardon's hope, I know, and I think our hope if we pass this on, is that this will be doing much more than just talking and preparing a report that goes on a shelf that is then ignored for all eternity. So that's essentially what this bill is doing.
Okay. Well, I need to, you know, add to my remarks, because the fact is that Glarby Foods is actually financially supporting the group there at Oregon State, and we believe very much in the research and their unique group in so much as that they're working hand in hand with the Oregon beekeepers and, you know, have already made certain discoveries about the pesticides, some of the other pesticides that are being used, and what their net effect is on the bees, and helping, you know, some of the seed growers realizing, you know, the mistakes on their part in terms of the uses of some of these pesticides. So, you know, we're giving 1% of our sales on the retail honey toward supporting the Oregon State group, and of course, you know, with that being the key element to this particular bill, you know, I'm in 100% support of that. So it's just exciting to be here today and
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Transke. Any other questions to the panel? Well, thank you very much, all three of you, for coming
thank
forward.
Thank you.
Okay, we have one more speaker. Elizabeth Remley has signed up. Sorry to leave you alone on that dais, Elizabeth.
Chair Dembro and members of the committee, I'm Elizabeth Remley here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Nurseries. Jeff Stone is sorry that he couldn't be here today. As Jeff Stone likes to say, nurseries are pro-stripe. We're bummed when the bees died. We don't like it when there are cases of colony collapse. We need bees to make our products grow and thrive and go to market. We're really grateful to Representative Reardon and the stakeholders who sat in and helped craft this legislation. We think it's an incredibly appropriate response to what happened last summer in Wilsonville and in other places. We're grateful to the League of Conservation Voters and the other conservation groups that came to the table and worked really well with us. We're grateful to the Oregonians for Food and Shelter for helping craft this bill. We're committed to finding a solution that works, and we're grateful that the legislature isn't taking a hasty response to this and instead is thinking really carefully about what to do next and what the appropriate response will be. So that's all I got.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Any questions for Elizabeth?
I have one.
Yes, Vice Chair Olson.
Well, I hate to put this crassly, but was it a godsend that we had that bee kill off last year that we could look into this situation? Or were the nurserymen looking into it prior to this kill off?
Chair Olson, Chair Dembro, Representative Olson. It's 3 o'clock on a Wednesday. I wouldn't describe it as a godsend. I think we've known about colony collapse for a long time. I think we finally, it was demonstrated in a really colorful way last summer. But the nurserymen here in Oregon and across the country have been working at the national level for a long time to figure this out. And a lot of folks have been looking at this. So.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, Elizabeth. Okay, colleagues, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4139A. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 4139A. Chair Olson.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 4139A be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves that House Bill 4139A be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of this motion? Is there any opposition to this motion? Okay, seeing none, the motion is adopted. I'll carry this to the floor. Okay. With that, I'm going to close this work session on House Bill 4139A. And we'll go back to the public hearing on HJM 201A. Which remains open. Okay, we just have one person to speak, and that is Teresa Gibney, please.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
We've had a colony collapse.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I don't know that my testimony is needed based on the questions that were asked in the previous panel, but I'm Teresa Gibney, and I'm representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. My testimony is on OLIS, and just on behalf of, you know, a pound of prevention, an ounce of prevention is worth many pounds of cure, we urge your vote on behalf of HJM 201A. As you heard in earlier testimony, it's about a 434% increase in trail shipment just from year to year. And there are several, if you read many of the articles available on the web to the casual searcher, you'll see that it's expected to grow more and more, and that there are many grave concerns about the state of rail tanker shipping today, especially through the small communities that and large communities, population centers that these trains go through. So we urge your vote in support of HJM 201A.
Thank you very much, Teresa. Any questions for her?
I do have one, and it was a catastrophe in Canada. Did they ever determine the cause of that? Do you know?
Yeah, there were several things, and the same question, of course, was asked in House E&E. The response that was given there by the far more educated people at the panel at that time was that it was a comedy of errors. The original one was that the train was left running. There was a fire. When the people who addressed the fire came on, they turned off things on the train, did not reconnect the pieces of safety equipment that would keep those trains in place, and therefore the train rolled down the hill and then hit and exploded. But that is just the most visible. There have been four derailments in the last 6 months that have not been those kinds of comedies of errors, and pretty significant damage associated with all of them. Again, this is just from my casually going out after that question and looking at the reports on the internet and from, you know, Bloomberg and from from the energy, the U.S. version, not the International Energy Association, but the U.S. version of that. There's just a lot of reports out there.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you very much, Teresa. And colleagues, I will say I've also heard, as maybe you have, from the major rail companies, the Union Pacific, Burlington Northern, they're in support of this memorial as well. Is there anyone else that would like to speak on this bill? Okay, seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on HJM 201A. Sorry, it's not a bill, it's a memorial. And I'm going to open a public hearing on it.
How about a work session?
Work session. How about another public hearing?
No? Wow, no. Right. No. Everybody back up.
Mr. Chair, I move that HJM 201A be reported out of committee with a recommendation that it be adopted.
Vice Chair Olson moves that House Joint Memorial 201A be reported out of committee with a recommendation that it be adopted. Is there any discussion? Any opposition to the bill? Okay, memorial, sorry. Seeing none, the memorial is adopted. Anyone like to carry this bill, this
okay.
memorial? Okay, Vice Chair Olson will carry. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Joint Memorial 201A, and I'm going to open a public hearing on our final bill, which is House Bill 4041A. Beth, you want to tell us what this is?
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 4041A expands energy improvement program by authorizing local governments to facilitate private financing of energy improvements by property owners within certain requirements.
Okay. We'll go to Lisa. Okay. Hold on just a sec. Mark, do you want to vote on the memorial that we just passed?
Yes.
Yeah. Could somebody ask that the rules be suspended? And
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended. To allow us to take testimony and look at.
No, this is actually.
Well, law centers. Oh, no, I'm not going to do that. Mr. Chair, I'd ask the rules be suspended and by unanimous consent allow Senator Haas to vote.
Okay. Senator Bates requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reopening the work session.
Yeah.
And allowing Senator Haas to vote on House Joint Memorial 201A. Any discussion? Anyone have any problems with that? Okay, so rules are suspended. Do I need to reopen the work session? I'm going to reopen the work session on House Joint Memorial 201A. Senator Haas?
Haas votes yes.
Okay, Senator Haas votes yes. That makes us unanimous. And therefore.
We went for 4139. Did you miss that vote?
No, he was here for that. Okay, so I'm going to close the work session on House Joint Memorial 201A, and we are back on 4041A. I'm going to call up Lisa Abouaf. Anyway, you'll introduce yourself, Lisa. And Nancy Bennett? Yeah? Okay, great.
Perhaps I'll start.
Okay,
good afternoon,
you,
Chair Dembro. Members of the committee, I'm Nancy Bennett with Multnomah County, and John Talaska, our Economic Development Director, was planning to testify by phone today, but since we're moving this hearing forward, I'm going to just be here today, let you know that Association of Oregon County strongly supports this bill. Multnomah County strongly supports the bill. I'm happy to add on to things Lisa wants to say, but I'm going to let her talk to you about this bill and kind of why we're bringing this forward.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro and committee members. I'm Lisa Abouaf, and I'm the Central City Manager with the Portland Development Commission in Portland, Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today in support of House Bill 4041. As the city's Economic Development and Redevelopment Agency, PDC was invited by Multnomah County in 2012 to discuss the possibility of a C-PACE program in helping to spur economic activity and property redevelopment in the Portland area. At that time, I'm going to do a little bit of the background that John would have done. At that time, Multnomah County was just wrapping up a study that was looking at the potential for the use of a PACE program in Multnomah County, and their findings were that about 12% of the commercial buildings within the metro, within the county region, or 1,000 buildings, could be good candidates for energy efficiency. Another finding of that study was, in fact, that there were limitations to the way that the Oregon legislation was written because it mandated the use of public financing to secure the debt for any PACE program. We then jointly came forward and made recommendations to our government relations and are here today with the state to recommend that the program be expanded to allow for private financing as well as public financing. Building on the county's analysis, we also reached out to look at best practices nationwide. We spoke with folks in Connecticut, in Washington, D.C., and in California to understand what they were pursuing and how they had launched programs. We also took a look at the Portland market potential and the synergy of C-PACE programs with existing Portland Development Commission activities, both in neighborhood revitalization and in supporting the growth of our region's clean tech economy. The two programs that we reached, that we talked the most in depth about what we were with Washington, D.C. and Connecticut, and we identified commonalities between the two where they did program, they designed a program with the private sector and then launched the program. They entered into a partnership with an outside administrator, and last but not least, it was all predicated on what is called an open market financing model where local property owners and lenders can jointly be matched rather than going through the public sector. This allows for property owners to arrange their own financing and with the consent of any existing mortgage holders. Locally, at the same time, we worked with projects that we were already active on to identify if they would be good possible candidates for C-PACE, and we heard similar feedback from property owners and lenders within the Portland market. From a property owner point of view, an open market structure allows them to work with their day-to-day and known lenders, so with their own lenders who have already loaned on their commercial or multifamily projects. From a lender point of view, an open market allows them to enter into the market and to augment the services that they already provide to their existing clients. In summary, House Bill 4041 allows local governments to voluntarily establish PACE programs that also leverage private investment and economic activity. And it's for this reason that we urge you to support House Bill 4041. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lisa. I have a couple of questions. You know, one of the amendments I think that was made to the bill did have to do with the rights of mortgage holders. And could you speak more directly to that, just for the record?
Sure. I believe the amendment does allow for lender consent, and that is something that I believe when Multnomah County was looking at a program, they were assuming as well, and it's something that we've seen active in other programs nationwide.
Great.
It was not something that was written into the original bill, and so that's why it wasn't shown in the amendment.
Yeah, no, it sounds like a good addition. obviously, we're all concerned about jobs. So will this program, as you envision it, lead to job opportunities, within energy efficiency?
That is certainly the goal, and I can actually bring up...
Well, and maybe I could just add a little bit of what John was going to report about, that in our analysis we found that this doing this type of a program would generate over $40 million in local economic activity. It would provide over 200 person years of employment and save building owners and tenants $70 million in energy costs. So we definitely see it as an economic as well as just good for the environment.
And I would build on that. We've been working with Lloyd District property owners, an area in Portland, and they actually just completed a five-year energy strategy, and they identified just for commercial building stock within the Lloyd District in downtown Portland about $16 million in energy investments that could be done, which would generate to them an operating savings of $800,000 annual. So you can imagine that $16 million worth of improvements to capital assets that wouldn't be done necessarily otherwise without this program.
Great. Thank you, Lisa. Any questions? Yes, Senator Bates.
I just don't get it. If you want to do an improvement on your property and you borrow money for it, they're in second position, they're taking the risk with you. And in their second position, the first mortgage gets paid first before the second mortgage gets paid. So I don't understand why, to get the second mortgage, you're going to have okay for the first mortgagee. Secondly, I don't understand what this program does that an individual owner couldn't do anyway. My medical building, if I wanted to put solar on the roof, which we looked at, it didn't pencil for us, and unfortunately, it didn't. I wanted to, my partners didn't. How would this? So I'm in a position where I want to do it. I can't get it done for a price that pays off over 20 years, and I could float the money for it, but I wouldn't get a payback. And my partners don't want to do it. How would a program like this help me get that done? What would be different?
Maybe it's adding a tool to the toolbox rather than replacing all tools, I guess, would be the metaphor that I use. The idea is, I don't know who pays the utilities on your bill or who pays the property taxes. So very often it's actually the tenant who will pay it and not the property owner. And so there is what's called a split incentive, where if you go to a conventional lender, they'll look at it securitized by an asset versus via the savings. So that's one of the challenges, is some of the improvements may not be secured by an asset that a lender feels confident in lending against. And the other is, as a property owner, if you have the split incentive between a property owner and a tenant, you may not be able to pass through the cost as well as pass through and recoup the savings. That's how the tool is different from a conventional loan and how it works within a lease structure. Does that make sense? So if you're a property
owner... I don't want to take the committee's time up, but I'll talk to you broadly about it, okay?
It's something that you'll often see referred to as a split incentive with the PACE program. And it's why it's used more frequently on multifamily and commercial housing rather than single-family homes, because you have that split property ownership and tenanting.
Okay, any other questions for these two? Okay, thank you both very much. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4041, and I'm going to open a work session on it.
Mr. Chair, yes. You ready for me? Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 4041A be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves that House Bill 4041A be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes.
I'm going to give you a courtesy yes, because I don't understand the program, and probably when it's cleared up in my head, I'll be okay.
Yes. I'll try to help, and I'm sure they can. Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. Any opposition to the motion? Okay. The motion carries. I'll carry the bill. And anything else for the good of the order, colleagues?
If we could postpone this for another hour, hour and a half, maybe somebody missing something.
yes. Okay. Stay tuned, colleagues, about future meetings. With that, we are adjourned. With that, we are adjourned.